Welcome back to Ancient Afterlives. I'm Joe Scales, and with me are Drs. Tina Rosala and Rick Bonney. We are resuming the second part of our deep dive discussion on the ancient synagogue. Thanks for joining us again, and on with the interview. So there was another kind of thing that came to mind there, and this might be an unfair question because it only appears in a chapter in the book you edited, Rick. But Karen Stern's piece on graffiti in synagogues. So as far as I can recall, and I'm really sorry if I butcher any her argument there, but she presents this kind of temporary writing or kind of non-officiated, let's say. So in contrast to inscriptional writing that we find in certain ancient synagogues, that kind of gives us a little bit more of a window into the communities who used those spaces rather than like the kind of the people who paid to have their names put in mosaics or inscribed onto stone. So I found that like another kind of window like these coins, which reflects maybe a bit more of like a communal use of these spaces. So I wondered if you want to talk about that or any other phenomena that come to mind that are kind of similar to these coin deposits.
Yeah, like I have the book here right open. I prepared. but yeah, like what I mean, the work of Karen Stern looking more like at like indeed these what communities in a way did inside these buildings. Like this, I think it's quite fascinating, and the way because in a way we have to look at each of these communities in their own way. Like if we look at just the like textual record, we get a general view of a general synagogue, of an, let's say an average synagogue building or an average community, what they might have done. But like ultimately, it gives this very generic picture, and it kind of it homogenizes these kind of people's behaviors in ways that through the archaeological record we can maybe somehow see this diversity and give more voice to the ones that might not be heard in the in through textual records. And I think that is something that like Karen Stern has done particularly well in not only this article, but also like other works that she has been doing. But it relates also a bit to the way that there are indeed these kind of like small signs that you sometimes have, like finds that have been lost. Like there's still in certain synagogues that have been certain kind of ceramics found on floor levels that show that there is different behavior being used. In one of the corners of the Hovad Kur synagogue, we have evidence for a later tabun, like a bread oven, and suggesting that at some point this might have been like quite soonish after other functions ended, might have been a century, might 2-3 centuries. It's hard to necessarily date this, but that there have been people using this space for perhaps just the living function. And so these buildings after they went perhaps out of use for a certain religious or political function, those elements stood there, the architectural elements, for like centuries, and sometimes like up until the present day. Like the synagogue of Baram in the very northern part of Israel is quite nice when the first explorers, Western European explorers, come to the region. They ultimately see that it's a house. There's a like people are living there, and a shepherd, if I remember right, and it's like the facade is being used in that, and an entire village is built around it. And so these buildings had so many functions, living, continuing, and like I think that is something that we often, let's say, as historians, archaeologists, we tend to focus so much on this kind of like primary functioning or like the origins, like we like the authentic use of it, even though we don't even know what is authentic in a way that like, but it's, let's say, the primary use of a building, or which perhaps the producer intended it to be.
That's interesting, Rick, because that's a phenomenon that archaeologists often have, right? We are attracted to the palaces and the temples and like the elite function of these buildings, right? But a lot of these buildings indeed had an afterlife after they went out of function for their primary reason. The normal people, the common people, would go in and take blocks from them and use them in their houses, or take decorative elements from them, or then go live in them, right? Because it was so well constructed. It was so monumental. You're not just going to leave it to waste after it went out of use or it was destroyed. You can still use it as a living space, as a storage space, as quarters. And so everyone could make use of that building in their own way. And we shouldn't just always look at what the elites were doing in specific spaces. I think that's an interesting
thing. Yeah, I mean, they were recognizable elements in the landscape long after their functioning, perhaps as synagogues, had ended.
Mm.
And because of that, because they were recognizable, people did things there or around it and made them do certain decisions. And yeah, that's something that is, I think, really interesting, but also a bit like underexplored in ways that, and this is not only for synagogues, this holds for almost any element where we always focus on this production and first use phase, and we never look at like how, and then we assume that this is the authentic way because, well, we do not really know, and what is authenticity in this kind of thing. And but these synagogues and like had lives that are still continuing. Like now they are heritage sites, and now they are being either reconstructed by us for some purposes, and so they have meaning, they have a functioning in today's world. And so like we are still kind of like users of that space. And in 1,000 or 2,000 or 500 years from now, we are part of this archaeological record.
Right. People will say, people in the year 2000 use them as like a heritage site to be in touch with their past, and they put up signs and plaques. And so they were used as like tourist centers for people coming back and finding the beginnings of their religion and exploring their heritage and their ancestors. And we're using that space now still as a way to connect with the past.
So yeah, this could perhaps be a larger topic. I'm really fascinated by this. Yeah, that the has Tina kind of very nicely on brand the afterlives of synagogues. But so from your perspective, both of you work in kind of heritage spheres as well. So particularly, I'm wondering whether we should talk specifically about synagogues in Israel-Palestine, or whether we should think kind of globally around the kind of ancient synagogue as a heritage phenomenon, and how they are kind of used in modern contexts. What's their meaning now? It seems to be slight. I was quite struck when I went to Ostia, where there's quite an ancient structure, and I wasn't prepared, because you walk into this ancient site at one end and you have to walk through the whole site and then out the other to get to this ancient synagogue. And my wife and I were the only people who had really trekked out that far to see it.
Oh no!
So there wasn't, when we were there at least, there didn't seem to be a massive amount of interest in it. and the kind of area of the archaeological park had been turned over to like a art installation. So there were lots of like modern art pieces kind of scattered around in the area as well. And then just this wonderful ancient synagogue with not really any information about it. Like you wouldn't necessarily have known to go out to look at this unless you're like a nerd like me and wanted
to. Yeah, in our field, it's like the Ostia synagogue and everyone wants to go to.
Yeah.
I can remember that I was in Ostia back in 2007 and I didn't visit it, but it was maybe my interest in some ways in the topic and as such. And we were there like with more students and doing some field work in actually Mitraeum. But it's actually funny that Joe, that you have this experience because while I have no like objective ideas about visitors to the synagogue site in Ostia, the colleague with whom I wrote the article on the late Hellenistic fountain house in Magdala, Julien Richard, actually is doing nowadays some fieldwork in Ostia, and like he says always that when they're like tourists coming, they are primarily there asking for the directions towards the synagogue. So suggesting that there is some kind of that it's indeed not well, like clearly signed, that it's at least shown, and that there are like people coming interested particularly for that element in the city of Ostia. So, but these are just two different ideas. I think the
use of ancient synagogues in modern Israel, Palestinian, Jewish, Christian tourism is fascinating. And I'm sure, Rick, you can say more about that. But the way how the synagogue at Magdala is now being treated as a tourist attraction for mostly American Protestants visitors versus how the one at Bar Am, where almost no one comes, but where they kind of like shunned it away from the old Arab village, is also fascinating. So I don't want to go too much into politics here, but it's clear that archaeology can be used for certain ideological goals. And I feel like ancient synagogues are definitely being used, at least at certain sites, for those goals. Rick?
Yeah. I would agree, and like this is quite clearly seen at least in the way the Bar Am synagogue, the heritage, the way it has been preserved. You have to remember that the Maronite villages was actually built around it and against the synagogue, which currently is not anymore there, on at least nearby the synagogue facade, but instead it has this very crisp and nice green grass that is quite strange to have in a very dry Israeli context. While if you just move about 90 degrees to your left, you will see a destroyed Maronite village. That is kind of a big statement to make. I don't know what the original planners have thought about it, but there is politics involved in how it is being displayed there. And that's not the only like site in Israel where these kind of things are highlighted. Like we don't hear about the destroyed settlements that were destroyed in the 1940s and 1960s underneath which some of the sites that we nowadays have like are exploring from the Roman Byzantine period, like those ruins are not clearly, they might be visible like if you would be able to recognize them, but they are not shown, signed in any ways, but it's the ancient material that is being signed. So like that is quite clear. In the case with what is also interesting, the way how, for instance, Capernaum, we have not even mentioned, I think, Capernaum. It's a bit strange.
How have we managed that?
Yeah, exactly. But the site of Capernaum, where you have this synagogue, which is almost entirely reconstructed in ways that, like, primarily by, like, primarily in the 1910s and 20s, like the entire walls are being reconstructed, and the columns and stuff. But how much that attracts a certain kind of tourism, like it's just on and off buses come on and off there. So, like that's more or less similar as the way how the one in Magdala is currently being trying to be, I guess, in some
right.
way. But so, yeah, you can say it's because of tourism, but there's also like political, religious ideas behind it for this kind of preservation manners. And that is kind of what I was hinting at, the way we are using these things. And so currently we can try to understand these kind of like heritage uses of synagogues, but probably in later centuries, we probably have a much better idea even, or we could better analyze that. And it's currently the case, but.
I mean, they're definitely being used as ideological symbols to cater towards certain groups, right? It's either Christian groups coming to the Galilee, walk in the steps of Jesus and go to the places where Jesus has been, which is clearly catering towards Christians, or, you know, see how ancient Jews have always lived here and how this has been like our country and our region from ancient times onwards, which is catering to a Jewish or sometimes even Zionist kind of perspective, where clearly these ancient sites are being used as pawns to set up a bigger political frame of what this country is and was and who it belongs to and who it caters to and who it doesn't cater to. The kind of languages that are being put up, the signs in English, in Hebrew, and mostly not in Arabic, or if they are in Arabic, there's for a certain reason, says a lot about the function nowadays of these heritage sites and who they are for and who they're not for.
Yeah, I guess that, yeah, I agree.
It's interesting that you're tying, yeah, because Capernaum, at least in some ways, has like a New Testament, like people read about it in the New Testament,
right?
And then you go there and they have the show of Peter's house and the church
right.
that's built above it and the synagogue that kind of stands opposite it, and there's a real like focal point between these two communities in the kind of the presentation of the site, let's say. And most of the, it's been a while since I've been there, but the domestic structures are largely, you can walk past them, they're still quite low, it's not reconstructed at all, but the synagogue stands and this modern kind of UFO shaped church stands. So there's something going on in the presentation of them there.
Right.
Magdala is kind of different in some ways. I'm really fascinated by the modern presentation of the site because I really like the openness of the park, and they do have quite good as far as kind of signage goes for like domestic areas or like reproposals of the port and things like that. So you can walk around and see ancient Jewish life or the
right.
remains of what was ancient Jewish life. But they also have a chapel on site that
yes.
kind of the floor in one of the basements repurposes some kind of ancient marketplace. I'm not sure if that was exactly how they redid it, but it's definitely got that feel. And then
right.
all over there's this language of, well, Jesus preached in all the synagogues of the Galilee, so this is where he stood. So there's that real, to me, and again, this, I haven't been a long time to Capernaum, but that seems to almost self-evidently be, well, this is an important site for Christians, and Magdala is really trying to make it one.
Yes.
Perhaps. So there's like some really interesting dynamics going on between those two sites and what they do with their remains.
And it's also interesting. It's interesting to see what sites are being chosen to represent ancient Judaism or ancient Christianity and which ones are not, right? Like you said, going to Ostia, going to others. Me and Rick have been trying to find ancient synagogues that we know have been excavated and driving around the countryside trying to find this monument that we just cannot find because no one takes care of it and there's no signage and no one cares about it. While the one at Magdala, the first thing that was constructed was a giant church next to it, a giant luxury hotel. There's going to be a pool. There's going to be facilities. That one is made as a sort of Las Vegas of the Galilee because of Mary Magdalene, I assume. It seems, I don't know, it seems kind of sometimes arbitrary which sites are being chosen, but then also very fascinating how it's being framed and who is funding it, and there are signs up of when the Pope visited the site and how it like connected to to Christian revival. And it's a very interesting case. It's also kind of a shame because now that hotel is there and that large giant church is there, and so you're not going to be able to excavate around the synagogue anymore because it's all covered up by modern architecture. So clearly they're happy with just having the couple of houses and that synagogue, and then that's it. So archaeologically, they're not very interested in anything around it anymore. This is just going to be it for now. But they're building a giant parking lot. The goal is to get tourists in there on a daily basis and make money off it, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, it's also quite much on like good infrastructure. Like, mm-hmm. So, like it's near to Capernaum, to Tapka, to other places where so it has this like a lot of tourist infrastructure. While indeed Dean and I have been traveling around Upper Galilee to find some like sites, and indeed it's really hard to find it. It has to do with like perhaps with the locality, but it's also like it's not on the path of the tourists.
No, but they can make it. They could if they wanted to.
Of course. But you can see that's catering to Christian tourists in particular, I think, and that's why the Sea of Galilee, of course, is a very good place. I have not been to Magdala now in like 5, 6, 7 years, so I've seen the building rising, I think, but I've not seen it finishing in ways that you now described in some ways.
I was there 2 years ago, just before COVID, and it was. I mean, the hotel was pretty much done. The parking lot was being paved. It's a giant construction. Yeah.
What is interesting there, of course, is that we have you have on the one hand this like organization that at some point started to do these excavations there and then build. Or it was in the process of building a hotel, and during the rescue excavations, they found these kind of remains. And on the other part, you have this fenced off area that is owned by the Franciscans and has been excavated quite well and quite well published in though in Italian. That kind of is not accessible even to anybody. You by chance, I think I visited twice the area, mm-hmm. but it's like you need to
get special permission.
Yeah, you need to know the person, and luckily Jürgen Zangerberg knew the person, and that's why we got in. But for anybody, it's not there accessible, and also no signage, of course, but. Yeah, it's interesting how to deal with it. It's one town ultimately.
It's such a case in point in treating the remains so differently, and even in this case. So in the southern section there was the originally purported synagogue, so it's not even just the treatment of this bit has a synagogue in so we treat it differently, but just the owners want to do with the materials mm-hmm. has such a bearing on accessibility, public scholarship, knowledge about these places. Something to think on.
I guess.
We have the same discussion now about Horvath Kur, right? We have completed the entire excavation site, the synagogue. We are writing up our conclusions and our excavation reports, etc. And now the question has been brought up by us as well. What are we going to do with this site? For the moment, there is no funding or no particular goal to have it open to tourism. Also, it's very remote. You would have to build a road. Like, you can only get there with like a jeep and walking up the hill. And so you would have to build all kind of infrastructure around it. And who is going to fund that? On the other hand, now it's just, you know, we've excavated it. We have tried to, you know, restore it, or not restore it, but preserve it as best as we can, taking out all the important pieces and brought them to the museum for protection, etc., so that it wouldn't get looted or destroyed by the weather. But yeah, now we're just going to kind of like leave it, I guess. It's a tough question.
Yeah, I mean, it brings me to a point about like what is sometimes a bit, like I would say perhaps sad to see that indeed Tina already hinted already the focus on the monumental, the focus on these like public buildings. And like one thing that I think it was already back in the 70s, it was Eric Myers who started this focus on like the village culture as such and wanted to explore what is beyond the synagogue and did that in certain cases. In certain cases, it was a bit more difficult due to the circumstances there. But it's still up to today, still quite that the focus always shifts towards that public building and how that building is connected in the actual town, how like which house was situated next to it, like that's. Could be quite an important house of some sort, and what kind of spaces do we have, a more open space next to it or not? Like these kind of things remain underexplored in many ways, and it would be really nice to really focus on these things. It also has to do, of course, with like what sells to funding bodies.
Right. I was just gonna say it's not always up to the archaeologists, right? It kinda is, but it kinda is not. Because that was not the original plan for excavating Horvath Kur, that we would find a synagogue. The original plan was to excavate a normal little town in the Galilee that's not mentioned in the Bible or any other texts, and see what was a town, you know, like. What were people doing there? What kind of agriculture did they have? What kind of industry was happening? What kind of pots and pans did they have? And then we shifted away to the synagogue because people from the Antiquities Authority, people from the museum, people from the university would come and say, you have to excavate this. You are going to find important stuff here. You're going to find precious materials here, maybe a mosaic floor that needs to be protected, et cetera, et cetera. So you couldn't ignore that you just had like one wall or one half of a synagogue and stop and go back to the houses, because everyone kept asking about the synagogue and how the excavations were going there. So they're kind of forcing your hand to do that. And now we kind of want to go back to the village. And I feel like most of us, of the staff of Horvath Kur, wants to continue and go back to the houses and get more of those kind of questions. But now we're out of funding, so we have to apply for a new cycle of funding, and making the case that you want to excavate your average Joe's house is just not as attractive if you're competing with 100 other proposals from scientists saying that, oh, we found this giant palace in Assyria or something. And then, you know, you have to make more of a case that you want to do small history and you want to look at the average person, and it's also useful, et cetera, which of course you can do and which we will do. But they kind of do, like society kind of forces you to look at certain things more specific than other areas. Which is, yeah, it's still a remainder of, you know, 400 years of archaeology looking at palaces and temples.
Yeah.
Do you think that's at all related to questions around heritage? So before you found the synagogue, it was like, oh, they might find something really interesting. And now it's found, it's like, okay, you don't need to spend any more time at that site, or not at all?
Perhaps. What do you think, Rick?
You mean from the heritage authorities, or
well, whoever funded the initial dig? We can cut this.
I don't know. It's from both sides. I think it's both the, well, it's of course it's the length that it might take, but it's indeed there's a pressure from the authorities, perhaps that if you would, it is also because of preservation and potential looting.
Looting, yes.
That might mm-hmm. happen. So you might want to, once you have exposed a certain element, you might need to expose more and ultimately a complete one in order to make sure that everything gets documented properly and like preserved in the right manner. And as such, then even though you might have the intention to do only a small part, just like, let's say, a test case that you dig a couple of squares to identify the synagogue perhaps only, and then leave things unexposed for maybe future archaeologists to, with new methods and new insights and new theories to look at it, those elements that ultimately because of pressure from the larger public and these kind of aspects that I indicated, it's in practice difficult,
right? Which is exactly the case with Hukok, right? So mm-hmm. Hukok is another synagogue also in the Galilee, excavated by my PhD advisor Jody Magnus. And so in her career, she thought it very important to really date synagogues accurately. In the past, synagogues have often been dated based on their stylistic art historical features and not as much the archaeological remains inside or under the building. And so her plan was to go out there where she knew that there was going to be an ancient synagogue, excavate half of it, put out her assessment of this is the time in which it was constructed, renovated, etc., leave the other half for the future, like Rick said, and then future archaeologists would come around who have new methodologies in 100 years from now and like see if that was correct, her assessment, etc. And then they started finding these beautiful mosaic floors with panels portraying scenes from the New and Old Testaments and inscriptions, et cetera, et cetera. And so a lot of these unique panels have never been found before. Everyone got interested. National Geographic got involved. They got a big grant from National Geographic. And they were forced to excavate the entire building because you can't just leave half of the mosaic floors there. You also have to dig them out, make sure no one loots them. Etc. So they eventually excavated the entire building, and they're not quite done yet, but that's what they're going to get. And so it's very tricky when you're like, I'm only going to do a little part of this, you know, beautiful, important building and leave the rest. In reality, it's hard because you get pressure from all kinds of sides to just keep going.
Yeah. But indeed, like, despite all of that, I think from a research point of view, it would be important to really
understand. I agree.
Until we really get more better understanding of the surroundings of these synagogues, and to some degree that's particularly holding for the late antique ones, because for the few Second Temple period synagogues that we have, the context is quite good, the surrounding context. But for the late antique, it's like, considering the amount of synagogue buildings that we have in the region, it's still the village culture, the houses, the house domestic life, how is the archaeological record in houses near to the synagogue differ from those further away? That would be really interesting to start understanding better, and that would actually also help to understand what is the function of a synagogue, like how are synagogues used, because they are interrelated. Like it's that community that goes that accesses it, and vice versa. So in most cases, for most of the day, the synagogue might have been an empty building, as such. So. It's important to really understand those connections, and so I hope that Tine, in her new position, in her new job, might find ways to explore these things further. There.
Who knows?
I think that is really important.
I've got two more questions that should be quite brief that I'll put to both of you. The first will be, is there anything else that either of you feels we should bring up or discuss or touch upon? And then the second will be, do you have a kind of a particularly, let's just say a favorite synagogue and why? That would be just like a wrap-up closer one, but I can give you a minute to think about that. But is there anything else you want to touch upon, feel we need to bring up?
No. I think we gave a good overview. I mean, you can always dive into, let's talk about what's portrayed on mosaic floors.
We didn't, discuss the dating controversies.
I mean, you can't touch upon everything, right?
But it's maybe... Yeah, no, I think that is a bit difficult. We touched in a nice flow, I think, on a lot of things.
Yeah. So you don't have to answer this question. I'd like to have like a pithy, short question to finish things. But Tina, do you have a favorite synagogue? And why?
I have a favorite synagogue. Oh God! Well, of course, I have to say Horvat Gur. It's our baby. But if it's not Horvat Gur, I like the one at Umm El Qanatir. Mm-hmm. So there's a synagogue in Umm El Qanatir, which is all the way up in the Golan, and it was one of those rare instances where a synagogue was used, went out of use, was destroyed, fell apart over time, and then people never settled there again, and they didn't go and rob stones for their own architecture. So everything, when the archaeologists came, everything was still there in place. And what they did, and it was actually brilliant, the excavator, Yeshu Dre, he was an engineer, is an engineer. And so he said, okay, if we have all the blocks here, all the puzzles blocks, we can put this back together. So he actually invented a system in which he put a little computer chip in every block. He had all the blocks 3D scanned, and then the computer would tell them, okay, this block needs to go there to be able to fit together, because the blocks have different shapes. So you can put them back together how they originally were placed. And so he actually reconstructed pretty much the entire synagogue with the original stones, except for the roof. He also has the roof beams, but the tourism sectors, it's a little bit too dangerous to have tourists go in there. What if the roof collapses on top? People would be ashamed. So they're not doing the roof. But everything else has been reconstructed. The platform at the Bima and the Torah shrine has been reconstructed. And it's the closest, visiting that site is the closest you can get to actually visiting an ancient synagogue as it was, which I think is incredible. So I'm going with that one.
Rick?
Yeah. Well, of course, first of all, I will go with the whole thing. the nice thing, of course, there being like, and kind of having been there like in 2008 when the first part of its wall was being exposed, it's the nice thing that it's kind of nice, but you literally know literally almost every little shirt or in my part also like iron metal nails that have been found in the synagogue. At some point I started to study the metal nails and what they can tell us about the second floor. Second level, for instance, or about small caskets with coins. That's kind of fascinating. But if there should be a second one again, I would. It's a hard one in ways that I think I would still think that I would go for the Baram Synagogue, partly because of this complexity in the way. And the layers that are there, the way the people in the 1830s started to describe things, it's maybe not the synagogue as such, but it's the surroundings, and there's so much complexity in it as a heritage site that. It's probably not the right word to say I like it, therefore, but it's something that really interests me.
So I will pick, so I, this is also a slightly provocative one in some ways. I'm going to pick the Gamla Basilica. So we've talked about the Gamla Synagogue, which is almost universally identified as a synagogue on the basis of all the architectural features. But there is another building at the other end of Gamla that is also a monumental building that's laid out very, very differently. But if certain identifications of what are really rooms as synagogues from the first and second centuries are allowed to fly, that are smaller rooms than the main hall in this one, I think we should at least entertain the possibility that the term synagogue should be really expansive. So why not call another monumental structure that clearly has some communal purpose in ancient Gamla another synagogue? That's my one.
It relates to like the question of like functionality in ways that when we like as archaeologists we tend to define functionality quite often or like identify buildings quite often based on these like on architectural similarities, and that's very dangerous, I think, especially with such a vague term as the term synagogue. And there have been indeed in the past like certain parts, like certain sites, like for instance the site of Horvat Etri has a kind of a communal building or communal space that doesn't have benches, or at least stone benches, and the excavators have suggested it might be a synagogue, but it's conventionally being not recognized as a synagogue. But it fits all the similarities in a way when I suggest the semi-public late Second Temple period synagogue. It has that kind of similarities, and as such, like I don't know exactly the one in Gamla that Joe is talking about now, but like we have to think about how these spaces were actually being used, how they were accessed and stuff. That tells in a way also about the functionality, maybe beyond the architectural like markings. But yeah, that brought me up in this idea when you said that.
Well, thank you both so much. I've really enjoyed that discussion and just listening to you both talk about your wealth of experience and interests. Great. Thank you to all our listeners. And in conjunction with this episode, I will also be doing a giveaway of the book that Rick edited. Publishers have mistakenly sent me two, and they are happy for me to give away one of them. So I will still have my much well-thumbed copy, but I will also do a giveaway of this as well.
Great. Well, thank you, Joe. Thank you for having us. This was a lot of fun.
Yes, this was very much fun. I enjoyed it. I don't talk so often anymore about synagogues. So.
Well, we'll have to like talk to you at some point about what you do want to talk about now. Now you've like done an hour and a half of synagogue chat. We can just, okay, what do you want to talk about?
No. I can't stand you.
Thanks once again to Rick and Tina for their time and the fascinating discussion we had. I feel like I learned so much just sharing that with everyone. Giveaways are still ongoing at the time of this posting, so if you are interested in winning one of the two volumes that I mentioned the week before, then head on over to our Twitter spaces, either my personal Twitter or the Ancient Afterlife Twitter account, for a chance to win one of these fantastic volumes. Thanks for listening, and look after yourselves. See you all soon.